Before fixing an imperious glance on the child. "Go and play in the drawing-room, my dear. I wish to speak to your mamma." Madame de Villefort shuddered at the sight of that cold countenance, that resolute tone, and the awfully strange preliminaries. Edouard raised his head, looked at his mother, and then, finding that she did not confirm the order, began cutting off the heads of his leaden soldiers. "Edouard!" cried Monsieur de Villefort, so harshly that the child started on the carpet. "Do you hear me? Go!" The child, unaccustomed to such treatment, rose pale and trembling. It would be difficult to say whether his emotion were caused by fear or passion. His father went up to him, took him in his arms, and kissed his forehead. "Go," he said. "Go, my child." Edouard ran out. Monsieur de Villefort went to the door, which he closed behind the child and bolted. "Oh, heavens!" said the young woman, endeavouring to read her husband's inmost thoughts, while a smile passed over her countenance which froze the impassibility of Villefort. "What is the matter?"
"Madame, where do you keep the poison you generally use?" said the magistrate, without any introduction, placing himself between his wife and the door. Madame de Villefort must have experienced somewhat of the sensation of a bird which, looking up, sees the murderous trap closing over its head. A hoarse, broken tone, which was neither a cry nor a sigh, escaped from her, while she became deadly pale.
"Sir," she said, I do not understand you."
And as in her first paroxysm of terror she had raised herself from the sofa, in the next, stronger very likely than the other, she fell down again on the cushions.
"I asked you," continued Villefort, in a perfectly calm tone, "where you conceal the poison by the aid of which you have killed my father-in-law, Monsieur de Saint Méran, my mother-in-law, Madame de Saint Méran, Barois, and my daughter, Valentine."
"Ah, sir," exclaimed Madame de Villefort, clasping her hands, "what do you say?"
"It is not for you to interrogate, but to answer.
Is it to the judge or to the husband?"
stammered Madame de Villefort.
"To the judge. To the judge, madame."
It was terrible to behold the frightful pallor of that woman, the anguish of her look, the trembling of her whole frame.
"Ah, sir," she muttered. "Ah, sir."
And this was all.
"You do not answer, madame," exclaimed the terrible interrogator. Then he added with a smile yet more terrible than his anger, "It is true, then. You do not deny it."
She moved forward.
"And you cannot deny it," added Villefort,
extending his hand towards her as though to seize her in the name of justice.
"You have accomplished these different crimes with impudent address, but which could only deceive those whose affection for you blinded them. Since the death of Madame de Saint Méran, I have known that a poisoner lived in my house. Monsieur d'Avrigny warned me of it. After the death of Barois, my suspicions were directed towards an angel, those suspicions which, even when there is no crime, are always alive in my heart. But after the death of Valentine, there has been no doubt in my mind, madame, and not only in mine, but in those of others. Thus, your crime, known by two persons, suspected by many, will soon become public, and, as I told you just now, you no longer speak to the husband, but to the judge."
The young woman hid her face in her hands.
"Oh, sir," she stammered, "I beseech you, do not believe appearances."
"Are you, then, a coward?" cried Villefort, in a contemptuous voice. "But I have always remarked that poisoners were cowards. Can you be a coward, you who have had the courage to witness the death of two old men and a young girl murdered by you?"
"Sir, sir."
"Can you be a coward?" continued Villefort with increasing excitement. "You who could count one by one the minutes of four death agonies? You who have arranged your infernal plans and removed the beverages with a talent and precision almost miraculous? Have you, then, who have calculated everything with such nicety, have you forgotten to calculate one thing? I mean, where the revelation of your crimes will lead you to? Oh, it is impossible. You must have saved some surer, more subtle and deadly poison than any other, that you might escape the punishment you deserve. You have done this. I hope so, at least.
Madame de Villefort stretched out her hands and fell on her knees.
I understand, he said. You confess. But a confession made to the judges, a confession made at the last moment, extorted when the crime cannot be denied, diminishes not the punishment inflicted on the guilty.
The punishment? Exclaimed Madame de Villefort. The punishment, sir? Twice you have pronounced that word.
Certainly. Did you hope to escape it because you were four times guilty? Did you think the punishment would be withheld because you are the wife of him who pronounces it? No, madame, no. The scaffold awaits the poisoner, whoever she may be, unless, as I just said, the poisoner has taken the precaution of keeping for herself a few drops of her deadliest poison.
Madame de Villefort uttered a wild cry, and a hideous and uncontrollable terror spread over her distorted features.
"Oh, do not fear the scaffold, madame," said the magistrate. "I will not dishonor you, since that would be to dishonor myself. No, if you have heard me distinctly, you will understand that you are not to die on the scaffold."
"No, I did not understand." "What do you mean?"
stammered the unhappy woman, completely overwhelmed.
"I mean that the wife of the first magistrate in the capital shall not, by her infamy, soil an unblemished name, that she shall not with one blow dishonor her husband and her child."
"No, no, oh no!"
"Well, madame, it will be a laudable action on your part, and I will thank you for it."
"You will thank me? For what?"
"For what you have just said."
"What did I say? Oh, my brain whirls. I no longer understand anything. Oh, heavens! Oh, heavens!"
And she rose with her hair disheveled and her lips foaming.
"Have you answered the question I put to you on entering the room? Where do you keep the poison you generally use, madame?"
Madame de Villefort raised her arms to heaven and convulsively struck one hand against the other.
"No, no," she vociferated. "No, you cannot wish that."
"What I do not wish, madame, is that you should perish on the scaffold. Do you understand?" asked Villefort.
"Oh, mercy, mercy, sir."
"What I require is that justice be done. I am on the earth to punish, madame," he added with a flaming glance. "Any other woman, were it the queen herself, I would send to the executioner. But to you I shall be merciful. To you I will say, have you not, madame, put aside some of the surest, deadliest, most speedy poison?"
"Oh, pardon me, sir. Let me live."
"She is cowardly," said Villefort.
"Reflect that I am your wife."
"You are a poisoner."
"In the name of heaven."
"No."
"In the name of the love you once bore me."
"No, no."
"In the name of our child. Ah, for the sake of our child, let me live."
"No, no, no. I tell you, one day, if I allow you to live, you will perhaps kill him as you have the others."
I kill my boy?" cried the distracted mother, rushing towards Villefort. "I kill my son?"
And a frightful, demoniac laugh finished the sentence, which was lost in a hoarse rattle. Madame de Villefort fell at her husband's feet. He approached her.
"Think of it, madame," he said. "If, on my return, justice has not been satisfied, I will denounce you with my own mouth and arrest you with my own hands."
She listened, panting, overwhelmed, crushed. Her eye alone lived and glared horribly.
"Do you understand me?"
he said.
"I am going down there to pronounce the sentence of death against a murderer. If I find you alive on my return, you shall sleep tonight in the conciergerie."
Madame de Villefort sighed. Her nerves gave way, and she sunk on the carpet. The procureur du roi seemed to experience a sensation of pity. He looked upon her less severely, and bowing to her, said slowly,
"Farewell, madame. Farewell."
That farewell struck Madame de Villefort like the executioner's knife. She fainted. The procureur du roi went out, after having double-locked the door. 110. The Assizes. The Benedetto affair, as it was called in the Palais, and by people in general, had produced a tremendous sensation. Frequenting the Café de Paris, the Boulevard de Gand, and the Bois de Boulogne, during his brief career of splendour, the false Cavalcanti had formed a host of acquaintances. The papers had related his various adventures both as the man of fashion and the galley-slave, and as everyone who had been personally acquainted with the Prince Cavalcanti experienced a lively curiosity in his fate, they all determined to spare no trouble in endeavouring to witness the trial of Monsieur Benedetto for the murder of his comrade. In the eyes of many, Benedetto appeared, if not a victim too, at least an instance of the fallibility of the law. Monsieur Cavalcanti, his father, had been seen in Paris, and it was expected he would reappear to claim the illustrious outcast. Many also, who were not aware of the circumstances attending his withdrawal from Paris, were struck with the worthy appearance, the gentlemanly bearing, and the knowledge of the world displayed by the old patrician, who certainly played the nobleman very well, so long as he said nothing, and made no arithmetical calculations. As for the accused himself, many remembered him as being so amiable, so handsome, and so liberal, that they chose to think him the victim of some conspiracy, since in this world large fortunes frequently excite the malevolence and jealousy of some unknown enemy. Everyone, therefore, ran to the court, some to witness the sight, others to comment upon it. From 7 o'clock in the morning a crowd was stationed at the iron gates, and an hour before the trial commenced the hall was full of the privileged. Beauchamp, one of the kings of the press, and therefore claiming the right of a throne everywhere, was looking round on every side. He perceived Chateaurenault and Debray, who had just gained the good graces of a sergeant de ville, and who had persuaded the latter to let them stand before instead of behind him, as he ought to have done. The worthy agent had recognized the minister's secretary and the millionaire, and, by way of paying extra attention to his noble neighbors, promised to keep their places while they paid a visit to Beauchamp.
"Well," said Beauchamp, "we shall see our friend."
"Yes, indeed," replied Debray. "That worthy prince. Deuce take those Italian princes.
A man, too, who could boast of Dante for a genealogist and could reckon as far back as the Divina Commedia."
"A nobility of the rope," said Chateaurenault phlegmatically.
"He will be condemned, will he not?" asked Debray of Beauchamp.
"My dear fellow, I think we should ask you that question. You know such news much better than we do. Did you see the president at the minister's last night?"
"Yes."
"What did he say?"
"Something which will surprise you."
"Oh, make haste and tell me, then. It is a long time since that has happened."
"Well, he told me that Benedetto, who is considered a serpent of subtlety and a giant of cunning, is really but a very subordinate, silly rascal, and altogether unworthy of the experiments that will be made on his phrenological organs after his death."
"Bah," said Beauchamp, "he played the prince very well."
"Yes, for you who detest those unhappy princes, Beauchamp, and are always delighted to find fault with them. But not for me, who discover a gentleman by instinct, and who scent out an aristocratic family like a very bloodhound of heraldry." Then you never believed in the Principality?
Yes, in the Principality, but not in the Prince.
Not so bad, said Beauchamp. Still, I assure you he passed very well with many people. I saw him at the ministers' houses.
Ah, yes, said Château Renaud. The idea of thinking ministers understand anything about princes.
There is something in what you have just said, said Beauchamp, laughing.
But, said Debray to Beauchamp,
if I spoke to the president, you must have been with the Procureur du Roi. It was an impossibility. For the last week, Monsieur de Villefort has secluded himself. It is natural enough. This strange chain of domestic afflictions, followed by the no less strange death of his daughter.
Strange? What do you mean, Beauchamp?
Oh, yes. Do you pretend that all this has been unobserved at the minister's?
Said Beauchamp, placing his eyeglass in his eye, where he tried to make it remain.
My dear sir, said Château Renaud, allow me to tell you that you do not understand that manoeuvre with the eyeglass half so well as Debray. Give him a lesson, Debray.
Stay, said Beauchamp. Surely I am not deceived.
What is it?
It is she.
Whom do you mean?
They said she had left.
Mademoiselle Eugénie, said Château Renaud, has she returned?
No, but her mother.
Madame Danglars? Nonsense. Impossible, said Château Renaud. Only 10 days after the flight of her daughter and 3 days from the bankruptcy of her husband.
Debray coloured slightly and followed with his eyes the direction of Beauchamp's glance.
Come, he said. It is only a veiled lady, some foreign princess, perhaps the mother of Cavalcanti. But hush, gentlemen, here is the court. Let us get back to our places.
A noise was heard in the hall. The sergeant de ville called his two protégés with an energetic hum, and the doorkeeper, appearing, called out with that shrill voice peculiar to his order, even in the days of Beaumarchais,
"The court, gentlemen!"
The judges took their places in the midst of the most profound silence. The jury took their seats. Monsieur de Villefort, the object of unusual attention, and we had almost said of general admiration, sat in the armchair and cast a tranquil glance around him. Every person looked with astonishment on that grave and severe face, the calm expression of which personal griefs had been unable to disturb. And the aspect of a man who was a stranger to all human emotions excited a kind of terror.
"Gendarmes," said the president, "lead in the accused."
At these words the public attention became more intense, and all eyes were turned towards the door through which Benedetto was to enter. The door soon opened, and the accused appeared. His features bore no sign of that deep emotion which stops the beating of the heart and blanches the cheek. His hands gracefully placed one upon his hat, the other in the opening of his white waistcoat, were not at all tremulous. His eye was calm and even brilliant. Scarcely had he entered the hall when he glanced at the whole body of magistrates and assistants. His eye rested longer on the president, and still more so on the Procureur du Roi. By the side of Andrea was placed the lawyer who was to conduct his defence, and who had been chosen by the court. The president called for the deed of accusation, corrected, as we know, by the clever and implacable pen of de Villefort. During the reading of this, which was long, the public attention was continually drawn towards Andrea, who bore the burden with Spartan unconcern. Villefort had never been so concise and eloquent. The former life of the prisoner, his transformation, a review of his life from the earliest period, were set forth with all the talent that a knowledge of human life could furnish to a mind like that of the Procureur du Roi. Benedetto was thus for ever lost in public opinion before the sentence of the law could be pronounced. Andrea paid no attention to the successive charges which were brought against him. Monsieur de Villefort, who examined him attentively, and who, no doubt, practised upon him all the psychological studies he was accustomed to use, in vain endeavoured to make him lower his eyes, notwithstanding the depth and profundity of his gaze. At length the deed was read. "Accused," said the president, "your name and surname." Andrea rose.
"Excuse me, Monsieur le Président," he said in a clear voice, "but I see you are going to adopt a course of questions through which I cannot follow you.
I have an idea which I will explain by and by of making an exception to the usual form of accusation. Allow me then, if you please, to answer in different order, or I will not do so at all." The astonished president looked at the jury, who themselves looked upon the procureur du roi. The whole assembly manifested great surprise, but Andrea appeared quite unmoved. "Your age," said the president, "will you answer that question?" "I will answer that question as well as the rest, Monsieur le President, but in its turn." "Your age," repeated the president. "I am 21 years old, or rather I shall be in a few days, as I was born the night of the 27th of September, 1817. Monsieur de Vifor, who was busy taking down some notes, raised his head at the mention of this date. "Where were you born?" continued the president. "At Auteuil, near Paris." Monsieur de Vifor a second time raised his head, looked at Benedetto as if he had been gazing at the head of Medusa, and became livid. As for Benedetto, he gracefully wiped his lips with a fine cambric pocket handkerchief. "Your profession?" "First I was a forger," answered Andrea, as calmly as possible. "Then I became a thief, and lately have become an assassin." A murmur, or rather storm, of indignation burst from all parts of the assembly. The judges themselves appeared stupefied, and the jury manifested tokens of disgust for a stoicism so unexpected from a fashionable man. Monsieur de Vifor pressed his hand upon his brow, which, at first pale, had become red and burning. Then he suddenly rose and looked around as though he had lost his senses. He wanted air. "Are you looking for anything, Monsieur le Procureur du Roi?" asked Benedetto, with his most pleasing smile. Monsieur de Vifor answered nothing, but sat, or rather threw himself down again, upon his chair. "And now, prisoner, will you consent to tell your name?" said the president. "The brutal affectation with which you have enumerated and classified your crimes calls for a severe reprimand on the part of the court, both in the name of morality and for the respect due to humanity. You appear to consider this a point of honour, and it may be for this reason you have delayed acknowledging your name. You wished it to be preceded by all these titles. It is quite wonderful, Monsieur le Président, how entirely you have read my thoughts," said Benedetto, in his softest voice and most polite manner. "This is, indeed, the reason why I begged you to alter the order of the questions." The public astonishment had reached its height. There was no longer any deceit or bravado in the manner of the accused. The audience seemed like some thundercloud about to burst over the gloomy scene. "Well," said the president, "your name?" "I cannot tell you my name, since I do not know it, but I know my father's and will pronounce it." "Repeat your father's name," said the president. Not a whisper, not a breath was heard in that vast assembly. Everyone waited anxiously. "My father is the Procureur du Roi," replied Andrea calmly. "The Procureur du Roi?" said the president, stupefied and without noticing the agitation which spread over the face of Monsieur de Vifor. "The Procureur du Roi? Yes, and if you wish to know his name, I will tell it. He is named Vifor." The explosion which had been so long restrained from a feeling of respect to the court of justice now burst forth like thunder from the breasts of all present. The court itself did not seek to restrain the movement of the multitude. The exclamations, the insults addressed to Benedetto, who remained perfectly unconcerned, the energetic gestures, the movement of the gendarmes, the sneers of the scum of the crowd, always sure to rise to the surface in case of any disturbance, all this lasted 5 minutes before the doorkeepers and magistrates were able to restore silence. Several persons hurried up to Monsieur de Vifor, who was nearly buried in his chair, offering him consolation, encouragement, and protestations of zeal and sympathy. Order was re-established in the hall, with the exception of a few who still moved and whispered. A lady, it was said, had just fainted. They had supplied her with a smelling bottle, and she had recovered. During the scene of tumult, Andrea had turned his smiling face towards the assembly, then, leaning with one hand on the oaken rail of his bench, in the most graceful attitude possible, he said, "Gentlemen, I assure you I had no idea of insulting the court, or of making a useless disturbance in the presence of this honourable assembly. They ask my age, I tell it. They ask where I was born, I answer. They ask my name. I cannot give it since my parents abandoned me, but though I cannot give my own name, not possessing one, I can tell them my father's. Now I repeat, my father is named Monsieur de Villefort, and I am ready to prove it." There was an energy, a conviction, and a sincerity in the manner of the young man which silenced the tumult. All eyes were turned for a moment towards the Procureur du Roi, who sat as motionless as though a thunderbolt had changed him into a corpse. "Gentlemen," said Andrea, commanding silence by his voice and manner, "I owe you the proofs and explanations of what I have said." "But," said the irritated President, "you called yourself Benedetto, declared yourself an orphan, and claimed Corsica as your country. I said anything I pleased, in order that the solemn declaration I have just made should not be withheld, which otherwise would certainly have been the case. I now repeat that I was born at Auteuil on the night of the 27th September, 1817, and that I am the son of the Procureur du Roi, Monsieur de Villefort. Do you wish for any further details? I will give them. I was born in No. 28 Rue de la Fontaine, in a room hung with red damask. My father took me in his arms, telling my mother I was dead, wrapped me in a napkin marked with an H and an N, and carried me into a garden where he buried me alive. A shudder ran through the assembly when they saw that the confidence of the prisoner increased in proportion with the terror of Monsieur de Villefort. But how have you become acquainted with all these details?" asked the President. "I will tell you, Monsieur le Président. A man who had sworn vengeance against my father, and had long watched his opportunity to kill him, had introduced himself that night into the garden in which my father buried me. He was concealed in a thicket. He saw my father bury something in the ground, and stabbed him in the midst of the operation. Then, thinking the deposit might contain some treasure, he turned up the ground and found me still living. The man carried me to the hospital for Enfants Trouvés, where I was inscribed under the number 37. 3 months afterwards, a woman travelled from Rogliano to Paris to fetch me, and having claimed me as her son, carried me away. Thus, you see, though born in Paris, I was brought up in Corsica." There was a moment's silence, during which one could have fancied the hall empty, so profound was the stillness. "Proceed," said the President. "Certainly, I might have lived happily amongst those good people who adored me, but my perverse disposition prevailed over the virtues which my adopted mother endeavoured to instil into my heart. I increased in wickedness till I committed crime. One day, when I cursed Providence for making me so wicked and ordaining me to such a fate, my adopted father said to me, 'Do not blaspheme, unhappy child. The crime is your father's, not yours. Your father's, who devoted you to death or to a life of misery, in case by a miracle you should escape his doom.' Since then, I cease to blaspheme, but I curse my father. This is why I have uttered the words for which you blame me. This is why I have filled this whole assembly with horror. If I have committed an additional crime, punish me. But if you will allow that ever since the day of my birth, my fate has been sad, bitter, and lamentable, then pity me." "But your mother?" asked the President. "My mother thought me dead. She is not guilty. I did not even wish to know her name, nor do I know it." Just then a piercing cry, ending in a sob, burst from the centre of the crowd, who encircled the lady who had before fainted, and who now fell into a violent fit of hysterics. She was carried out of the hall, and in doing so the thick veil which concealed her face dropped off, and Madame Danglars was recognised. Notwithstanding his shattered nerves, the stunning sensation in his ears, and the species of madness which turned his brain, Villefort rose as he perceived her. "The proofs, the proofs," said the President. "Remember, this tissue of horrors must be supported by the clearest proofs." "The proofs," said Benedetto, laughing. "Do you want proofs?" "Yes." "Well, then, look at Monsieur de Villefort, and then ask me for proofs." Everyone turned towards the Procureur du Roi, who, unable to bear the universal gaze now riveted on him alone, advanced staggering into the midst of the tribunal, with his hair dishevelled and his face indented with the mark of his nails. The whole assembly uttered a long murmur of astonishment. "Father," said Benedetto. "I am asked for proofs. Do you wish me to give them?"
"No. No, it is useless," stammered Monsieur de Villefort in a hoarse voice. "No, it is useless."
"How useless?" cried the president. "What do you mean?"
"I mean that I feel it impossible to struggle against this deadly weight which crushes me. Gentlemen, I know I am in the hands of an avenging God. We need no proofs. Everything relating to this young man is true."
A dull, gloomy silence, like that which precedes some awful phenomenon of nature, pervaded the assembly, who shuddered in dismay.
"What?
Monsieur de Villefort," cried the president, "do you yield to a hallucination? What, are you no longer in possession of your senses? This strange, unexpected, terrible accusation has disordered your reason. Come, recover." The procureur du roi dropped his head. His teeth chattered like those of a man under a violent attack of fever, and yet he was deadly pale.
"I am in possession of all my senses, sir," he said. "My body alone suffers, as you may suppose. I acknowledge myself guilty of all the young man has brought against me, and from this hour hold myself under the authority of the procureur du roi who will succeed me."
And as he spoke these words with a hoarse, choking voice, he staggered towards the door, which was mechanically opened by a doorkeeper. The whole assembly were dumb with astonishment at the revelation and confession which had produced a catastrophe so different to that which had been expected during the last fortnight by the Parisian world. "The sitting is adjourned, gentlemen," said the president. "Fresh inquiries will be made, and the case will be tried next session by another magistrate." As for Andrea, who was as calm and more interesting than ever, he left the hall, escorted by gendarmes who involuntarily paid him some attention.
"Well, what do you think of this, my fine fellow?" asked Debray of the sergeant de ville, slipping a louis into his hand.
"There will be extenuating circumstances," he replied. 111. Expiation. Notwithstanding the density of the crowd, Monsieur de Villefort saw it open before him. There is something so awe-inspiring in great afflictions that even in the worst times, the first emotion of a crowd has generally been to sympathize with the sufferer in a great catastrophe. Many people have been assassinated in a tumult, but even criminals have rarely been insulted during their trial. Thus, Villefort passed through the mass of spectators and officers of the palais and withdrew. Though he had acknowledged his guilt, he was protected by his grief. There are some situations which men understand by instinct, though their reason cannot explain them. In such cases, the greatest orator is he who utters the loudest and most natural cry, which conveys a whole story to the mob. It would be difficult to describe the state of stupor in which Villefort left the palais. Every pulse beat with feverish excitement, every nerve was strained, every vein swollen, and every part of the body seemed to suffer distinctly from the rest, thus multiplying his agony a thousandfold. Habit alone guided him through the passage. He threw aside his magisterial robe. He could not bear the weight on his shoulders. Having staggered as far as the Rue Dauphine, he perceived his carriage, awoke his sleeping coachman by opening the door himself, threw himself on the cushions, and pointed towards the Faubourg Saint-Honoré. The carriage drove on. All the weight of his fallen fortune seemed suddenly to crush him. He could not foresee the consequences. He could not contemplate the future with the indifference of a cold murderer. One thought filled his mind. He saw the workings of a divine hand in all that had happened. The carriage rolled rapidly. Villefort, while turning restlessly on the cushions, felt something press against him. He put out his hand to remove the object. It was a fan which Madame de Villefort had left in the carriage. This fan awakened a recollection which darted through his mind like lightning. He thought of his wife. His wife! He had just acted the inexorable judge with her. He had condemned her to death, and she, crushed by remorse, struck with terror, covered with the shame inspired by the eloquence of his irreproachable virtue, she might at that very moment perhaps be preparing to die. An hour had elapsed since her condemnation. At that moment, doubtless, she was recalling all her crimes to her memory. She was asking pardon for her sins. Perhaps she was even writing a letter imploring forgiveness from her virtuous husband, of forgiveness she was purchasing with her death. Vifor again groaned with anguish and despair.
"Ah," he exclaimed, "that woman became criminal only from associating with me. I carried the infection of crime with me, and she has caught it as she would the typhus fever, the cholera, the plague. And yet I have punished her. I have dared to tell her. I have. Repent and die. But no, she must not die. She shall live and follow me. We will flee from Paris and go as far as the earth reaches. I told her of the scaffold, and I forgot that it awaits me also. Yes, we will fly. I will confess all to her. I will tell her daily that I also have committed a crime. Oh, what an alliance with the tiger and the serpent, worthy wife of such as I am. She must live, that my infamy may diminish hers. Yes, yes," repeated Vifor as he approached his home. "Yes, that woman must live. She must repent and educate my son, the sole survivor, with the exception of the indestructible old man of the wreck of my house. She loves him. It was for his sake she has committed these crimes. We ought never to despair of softening the heart of a mother who loves her child. She will repent. No one will know she has been guilty. The crimes which have taken place in my house, though they now occupy the public mind, will be forgotten in time, or if indeed a few enemies should persist in remembering them, why then I will add them to my guilty list. What will it signify if one, two, or three more are added? My wife and child shall escape from this gulf, carrying treasures with them. She will live and may yet be happy, since her child, in whom all her love is centered, will be with her. I shall have performed a good action, and my heart will be lighter."
And the Procureur du Roi breathed more freely than he had done for some time. The carriage stopped at the door of the hotel. Vifor leaped out of the carriage and saw his servants surprised at his early return. He could read no other expression on their features. Neither of them spoke to him. They merely stood aside to let him pass by, as usual, nothing more. As he passed by Monsieur Noirtier's room, he perceived through the half-open door two figures. But he experienced no curiosity to know who was visiting his father. Anxiety carried him on farther.
"Come," he said, as he ascended the stairs leading to his wife's room. "Nothing is changed here."
He then closed the door of the landing. "No one must disturb us," he said. "I must speak freely to her, accuse myself, and say—" He approached the door, touched the crystal handle, which yielded to his hand.
"Not locked," he cried. "That is well." And he entered the little room in which Edouard slept,
for though the child went to school during the day, his mother could not allow him to be separated from her at night. With a single glance, Vifor's eye ran through the room.
"Not here," he said. "Doubtless she is in her bedroom."
He rushed towards the door. It was bolted. He stopped, shuddering.
"Heloise!" he cried.
He fancied he heard the sound of a piece of furniture being removed.
"Heloise!" he repeated.
"Who is there?"
answered the voice of her he sought. He thought that voice more feeble than usual.
"Open the door," cried Vifor. "Open! It is I!"
But notwithstanding this request, notwithstanding the tone of anguish in which it was uttered, the door remained closed. Vifor burst it open with a violent blow. At the entrance of the room which led to her boudoir, Madame de Vifor was standing erect, pale, her features contracted, and her eyes glaring horribly.
"Heloise! Heloise!" he said. "What is the matter? Speak!"
The young woman extended her stiff white hand towards him.
"It is done, sir," she said,
with a rattling which seemed to tear her throat.
"What more do you want?"
And she fell on the floor. Vifor ran to her and seized her hand, which convulsively clasped a crystal bottle with a golden stopper. Madame de Vifor was dead. Vifor, maddened with horror, stepped back to the threshold of the door, fixing his eyes on the corpse.
"My son!" he exclaimed suddenly. "Where is my son? Edouard! Edouard!"
And he rushed out of the room, still crying,
"Edouard! Edouard!"
The name was pronounced in such a tone of anguish that the servants ran up.
"Where is my son?" asked Vifor. "Let him be removed from the house, that he may not see—" "Master Edouard is not downstairs, sir," replied the valet de chambre.
"Then he must be playing in the garden. Go and see."
"No, sir. Madame de Villefort sent for him half an hour ago. He went into her room and has not been downstairs since." A cold perspiration burst out in Villefort's brow. His legs trembled, and his brain filled with a confused maze of ideas.
"In Madame de Villefort's room?"
he murmured, and slowly returned, with one hand wiping his forehead, and with the other supporting himself against the wall. To enter the room, he must again see the body of his unhappy wife. To call Edouard, he must reawaken the echo of that room which now appeared like a sepulchre. To speak seemed like violating the silence of the tomb. His tongue clave to the roof of his mouth.
"Edouard," he stammered. "Edouard."
The child did not answer. Where, then, could he be, if he had entered his mother's room and had not since returned? He stepped forward. The corpse of Madame de Villefort was stretched across the doorway leading to the room in which Edouard must be. Those glaring eyes seemed to watch over the threshold, and the lips expressed a terrible and mysterious irony. Through the open door, a portion of the boudoir was visible, containing an upright piano and a blue satin couch. Villefort stepped forward two or three paces and beheld his child lying, no doubt asleep, on the sofa. The unhappy man uttered an exclamation of joy. A ray of light seemed to penetrate the abyss of despair and darkness. He had only to step over the corpse, enter the boudoir, take the child in his arms, and flee far, far away. He leaped over the corpse as though it had been a furnace. He took the child in his arms, pressed him, shook him, called him, but the child replied not. He pressed his burning lips to the cheeks, but they were icy cold and pale. He felt his stiffened limbs. He pressed his hand upon the heart, but it no longer beat. The child was dead. A folded paper fell from Edouard's breast. Villefort, thunderstruck, fell upon his knees. The child dropped from his arms and rolled on the floor by the side of its mother. He picked up the paper, and recognizing his wife's writing, ran his eyes rapidly over its contents. They were as follows. "You know that I was a good mother, since it was for my son's sake I became criminal. A good mother cannot depart without her son." Villefort could not believe his eyes. He could not believe his reason. He dragged himself towards the child's corpse and examined it as a lioness contemplates its dead cub. Then a piercing cry escaped from his breast and he cried, "Still the hand of God!" The two victims alarmed him. He could not bear the solitude only shared by two corpses. He rose, his head bent beneath the weight of grief, and shaking his damp, dishevelled hair, he, who had never felt compassion for anyone, determined to seek his father, that he might have someone to whom he could relate his misfortunes, someone by whose side he might weep. He descended the little stairs with which we are acquainted, and entered Noirtier's room. The old man appeared to be listening attentively and as affectionately as his infirmities would allow to the Abbé Busoni, who looked cold and calm as usual. Villefort, perceiving the Abbé, passed his hand across his brow. He recollected the call he had made upon him after the dinner at Auteuil, and then the visit the Abbé had himself paid to his house on the day of Valentine's death.
"You here, sir?" he exclaimed. "Do you then never appear but to act as an escort to death?"
Busoni turned round, and perceiving the excitement depicted on the magistrate's face, the savage lustre of his eyes, he understood that the scene of the assizes had been accomplished, but beyond this he was ignorant.
"I came to pray over the body of your daughter."
"And now, why are you here?"
"I come to tell you that you have sufficiently repaid your debt, and that from this moment I will pray to God to forgive you as I do."
"Good heavens!" exclaimed Villefort, stepping back fearfully. "Surely that is not the voice of the Abbé Busoni?"
"No."
The Abbé threw off his false tonsure, shook his head, and his hair, no longer confined, fell in black masses around his manly face.
"It is the face of the Count of Monte Cristo," exclaimed the Procureur du Roi, with a haggard expression.
"You are not exactly right, Monsieur le Procureur du Roi. You must go further back."
That voice! Where did I first hear it?"
"You heard it for the first time at Marseille 23 years ago, the day of your marriage with Mademoiselle de Saint-Marin. refer to your papers.
You are not Busoni. You are not Monte Cristo. Oh, heavens, you are then some concealed, implacable, and mortal enemy. I must have wronged you in some way at Marseille. Oh, woe to me!
Yes, you are indeed right, said the Count, crossing his arms over his broad chest. You condemned me to a horrible, tedious death. You killed my father. You deprived me of liberty, of love, and happiness.
Who are you, then? Who are you?
I am the spectre of a wretch you buried in the dungeons of the Chateau d'If. The form of the Count of Monte Cristo was given to that spectre when he at length issued from his tomb, enriched with gold and diamonds, to reconduct him to you.
Ah! I recognize you, I recognize you, exclaimed the Procureur du Roi. You are...
I am Edmond Dantès.
You are Edmond Dantès, cried Villefort, seizing the Count by the wrist. Then come here.
And he dragged Monte Cristo up the stairs, who, ignorant of what had happened, followed him in astonishment, presaging some new catastrophe.
Hold, Edmond Dantès, he said, pointing to the bodies of his wife and child. See, are you well revenged?
Monte Cristo became pale at this horrible sight. He felt he had passed beyond the bounds of vengeance, and that he could no longer say, God is for and with me. With an expression of indescribable anguish, he threw himself upon the body of the child, reopened its eyes, felt its pulse, and then rushed with him into Valentine's room, of which he double-locked the door.
My child, cried Villefort, he carries away the body of my child. Oh, curses, woe, death to you!
And he tried to follow Monte Cristo, but as though in a dream he was transfixed to the spot. His eyes glared as though they were starting through the sockets. He gripped the flesh on his chest until his nails were stained with blood. The veins of his temple swelled and boiled as though they would burst their narrow boundary and deluge his brain with living fire. This lasted several minutes, until the frightful overturn of reason was accomplished. Then, uttering a loud cry, followed by a burst of laughter, he rushed down the stairs. A quarter of an hour afterwards, the door of Valentine's room opened and Monte Cristo reappeared. Pale, with a dull eye and heavy heart, all the noble features of that face, usually so calm and serene, appeared overturned by grief. In his arms, he held the child whom no skill had been able to recall to life. Bending on one knee, he placed it reverently by the side of its mother, with its head upon her breast. Then, rising, he went out, and meeting a servant on the stairs, he asked, "Where is Monsieur de Villefort?" The servant, instead of answering, pointed to the garden. Monte Cristo ran down the steps, and, advancing towards the spot designated, beheld Villefort, encircled by his servants, with a spade in his hand and digging the earth with fury.
"It is not here!" he cried. "It is not here!"
And then he moved farther on, and recommenced digging. Monte Cristo approached him and said in a low voice, with an expression almost humble, "Sir, you have indeed lost a son, but..." Villefort interrupted him. He had neither listened nor heard.
"Oh, I will find it," he cried. "You may pretend he is not here, but I will find him, though I dig for ever."
Monte Cristo drew back in horror. "Oh," he said, "he is mad." And as though he feared that the walls of the accursed house would crumble around him, he rushed into the street, for the first time doubting whether he had the right to do as he had done.
"Oh, enough of this, enough of this," he cried. "Let me save the last."
On entering his house, he met Morel, who wandered about like a ghost. "Prepare yourself, Maximilian," he said with a smile. "We leave Paris tomorrow." "Have you nothing more to do there?" asked Morel. "No," replied Monte Cristo. "God grant I may not have done too much already." The next day they indeed left, accompanied alone by Batista. Aide had taken away Ali, and Bertuccio remained with Noirtier.
112. The Departure. The recent events formed the theme of conversation throughout all Paris. Emmanuel and his wife conversed with natural astonishment in their little apartment in the Rue Malais upon the three successive sudden and most unexpected catastrophes of Morcerf, Danglars, and Villefort. Maximilian, who was paying them a visit, listened to their conversation, or rather was present at it, plunged in his accustomed state of apathy. "Indeed," said Julie, "might we not almost fancy, Emmanuel, that those people, so rich, so happy but yesterday, had forgotten in their prosperity that an evil genius hovered over them, who, like the wicked fairies in Perrault's stories, presenting themselves unbidden at some wedding or baptism, has appeared all at once to revenge himself for their fatal neglect?" "What a dire misfortune," said Emmanuel, thinking of Morcerf and Danglars. "What dreadful sufferings," said Julie, remembering Valentine, but whom, with a delicacy natural to woman, she did not name before her brother. "If the Supreme Being has directed the fatal blow," said Emmanuel, "it must be that he, in his great goodness, has perceived nothing in the past lives of these people to merit mitigation of their awful punishment." "Do you not form a very rash judgment, Emmanuel?" said Julie. "When my father, with a pistol in his hand, was once on the point of committing suicide, had any one then said, 'This man deserves his misery,' would not that person have been deceived?" "Yes, but your father was not allowed to fall. A being was commissioned to arrest the fatal hand of death about to descend on him." Emmanuel had scarcely uttered these words when the sound of the bell was heard, the well-known signal given by the porter that a visitor had arrived. Nearly at the same instant, the door of the room was opened, and the Count of Monte Cristo appeared on the threshold. The young people uttered a cry of joy, while Maximilian raised his head, but let it fall again immediately. "Maximilian," said the Count, without appearing to notice the different impressions which his presence produced on the little circle, "I come to seek you." "To seek me?" repeated Morrel, as if awakening from a dream. "Yes," said Monte Cristo. "Has it not been agreed that I should take you with me, and did I not tell you yesterday to prepare for departure?" "I am ready," said Maximilian. "I came expressly to wish them farewell." "Whither are you going, Count?" asked Julie. "In the first instance to Marseille, madame." "To Marseille?" exclaimed the young couple. "Yes, and I take your brother with me." "Oh, Count," said Julie, "will you restore him to us, cured of his melancholy?" Morrel turned away to conceal the confusion of his countenance. "You perceive, then, that he is not happy," said the Count. "Yes," replied the young woman, "and I fear much that he finds our home but a dull one." "I will undertake to divert him," replied the Count. "I am ready to accompany you, sir," said Maximilian. "Adieu, my kind friends, Emmanuel, Julie, farewell." "How, farewell?" exclaimed Julie. "Do you leave us thus so suddenly, without any preparations for your journey, without even a passport?" "Needless delays but increase the grief of parting," said Monte Cristo, "and Maximilian has doubtless provided himself with everything requisite. At least I advised him to do so." "I have a passport, and my clothes are ready packed," said Morrel, in his tranquil but mournful manner. "Good," said Monte Cristo, smiling. "In these prompt arrangements we recognize the order of a well-disciplined soldier." "And you quit us thus?" said Julie. "At a moment's warning, you do not give us a day, no, not even an hour, before your departure?"
"My carriage is at the door, madame, and I must be in Rome in 5 days."
"But does Maximilian go to Rome?" exclaimed Emmanuel.
"I am going wherever it may please the Count to lead me," said Morrel, with a smile full of grief. "I am devoted to him for the next month."
"Oh, heavens! How strangely he expresses himself, Count," said Julie.
"Maximilian accompanies me," said the Count, in his kindest and most persuasive manner. "Therefore, do not make yourself uneasy on your brother's account."
"Once more, farewell, my dear sister."
"Emmanuel, adieu," Morrel repeated.
"His carelessness and indifference touch me to the heart," said Julie. "Oh, Maximilian,
Maximilian, you are certainly concealing something from us.
Pshaw, said Monte Cristo, you will see him return to you gay, smiling, and joyful.
Maximilian cast a look of disdain, almost of anger, on the Count.
We must leave you, said Monte Cristo, and on the eve of departure I carry my egotism so far as to say, do not forget me, my kind friends, for probably you will never see me again.
Never see you again? Exclaimed Emmanuel, whilst two large tears rolled down Julie's cheeks.
Never behold you again? It is not a man, then, but some angel that leaves us, and this angel is on the point of returning to heaven after having appeared on earth to do good.
Say not so, quickly returned Monte Cristo. Say not so, my friends. Angels never err. Celestial beings remain where they wish to be. Fate is not more powerful than they. It is they who, on the contrary, overcome fate. No, Emmanuel, I am but a man, and your admiration is as unmerited as your words are sacrilegious. And pressing his lips on the hand of Julie, who rushed into his arms, he extended his other hand to Emmanuel. Then, tearing himself from this house, the abode of peace and happiness, he made a sign to Maximilian, who followed him passively, with the indifference which was perceptible in him ever since the death of Valentine had so stunned him.
"Restore my brother to peace and happiness," whispered Julie to Monte Cristo,
and the Count pressed her hand in reply, as he had done 11 years before on the staircase leading to Morel's study.
"You still confide, then, in Sinbad the sailor?" asked he, smiling.
"Oh, yes," was the ready answer. "Well, then, sleep in peace and put your trust in the Lord."
As we have before said, the post-chaise was waiting. 4 powerful horses were already pawing the ground with impatience, whilst at the foot of the steps, Ali, his face bathed in perspiration and apparently just arrived from a long walk, was standing.
"Well?" asked the Count in Arabic. "Have you been to the old man's?"
Ali made a sign in the affirmative. "And have you placed the letter before him, as I ordered you to do?"
The slave respectfully signalized that he had. "And what did he say, or rather do?"
Ali placed himself in the light, so that his master might see him distinctly, and then, imitating in his intelligent manner the countenance of the old man, he closed his eyes as Noirtier was in the custom of doing when saying, "Yes."
"Good. He accepts," said Monte Cristo. "Now let us go."
These words had scarcely escaped him when the carriage was on its road, and the feet of the horses struck a shower of sparks from the pavement. Maximilian settled himself in his corner without uttering a word. 1/2 hour had fled when the carriage stopped suddenly. The Count had just pulled the silken check-string which was fastened to Ali's finger. The Nubian immediately descended and opened the carriage door. It was a lovely starlight night. They had just reached the top of the hill of Villejuif, the platform from whence Paris, like some dark sea, is seen to agitate its millions of lights, resembling phosphoric waves. Waves, indeed, more noisy, more passionate, more changeable, more furious, more greedy than those of the tempestuous ocean. Waves which never lie calm, like those of the vast sea. Waves ever destructive, ever foaming, and ever restless. The Count remained alone, and on a sign from his hand the carriage advanced some steps. He contemplated for some time with his arms crossed the vast city. When he had fixed his piercing look on this modern Babylon, which equally engages the contemplation of the religious enthusiast, the materialist, and the scoffer, "Great city," murmured he, inclining his head and joining his hands as if in prayer, "less than 6 months have elapsed since first I entered thy gates. I believe that the Spirit of God led my steps to thee, and that he also enables me to quit thee in triumph. The secret cause of my presence within thy walls I have confided alone to him, who only has had the power to read my heart. God only knows that I retire from thee without pride or hatred, but not without many regrets. He only knows that the power confided to me has never been made subservient to my personal good or to any useless cause. O great city, it is in thy palpitating bosom that I have found that which I sought. Like a patient miner, I have dug deep into thy very entrails to root out evil thence."
Now my work is accomplished, my mission is terminated. Now thou canst neither afford me pain nor pleasure. Adieu, Paris. Adieu. His look wandered over the vast plain like that of some genius of the night. He passed his hand over his brow, and getting into the carriage, the door was closed on him, and it quickly disappeared on the other side of the hill in a cloud of dust and noise. 113. The House in the Allée de Meilhan. 10 leagues were passed without a single word being pronounced. Morel was dreaming, and Monte Cristo